Why is the Duncan's First Nations suit against Alberta significant? And has the World Bank been greenwashing itself? Welcome to the Climate Recap from the Beckosphere Climate Corner, your go-to place for international and U.S.-based climate news. I'm Becky Hogue, a climate communicator. Today is Thursday, October 6th. Let's jump right into today's news. Let's start with some extreme weather events, or I guess the aftermath of them. U.S. President Biden announced $60 million to storm-proof Puerto Rico after Category 4 Hurricane Fiona. Previously, he had declared a disaster declaration there, which granted Puerto Ricans access to individual funds and public assistance. But then Puerto Ricans discovered that their 78 municipalities weren't considered eligible to receive the $700 individual payments from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. After sharing their outrage, FEMA added all municipalities to that list, but it makes me wonder if Puerto Ricans had access to those payments after Hurricane Maria. I'm also wondering how much it will cost to effectively storm-proof Puerto Rico. On the mainland, Florida is reeling from Category 4 Hurricane Ian. It's hard to miss images of devastation on many parts of the West Coast. Ian initially knocked out power for more than 4 million people, and nearly 400,000 households are still without power. The hurricane made landfall at Fort Myers, flattening the area. But there's one community located 12 miles from Fort Myers that not only survived, but didn't even lose power. Babcock Ranch was billed to be one of the most sustainable and resilient cities in the state. Heck, the nation. It's powered by a 870-acre solar farm made up of 650,000 solar panels. It's more than enough to power the 2,000 homes there and have excess energy to store in batteries to basically form its own mini-grid. There are also bonus rooftop and public solar installations. All the transmission wires are buried underground. Additionally, the town was specifically built above the storm surge zone, and roads are designed to minimize flooding. Flooding is also reduced by the amount of green space around, as half of the town's acreage is dedicated to parks, lakes, and greenways. The field house at the local high school was built as a storm shelter just in case too. Hurricane Ian was the first major storm to test Babcock Ranch's forethought, and the town not only survived, but provided a safe haven for places around that weren't so lucky. Babcock Ranch could be a great example of how to adapt a town to Florida's increasingly hostile climate, and it shows the impact of making a resilient city when it comes to cleanup costs. Time for some climate victories! Climate groups from all over the world, mainly Africa and Middle East, met in Tunisia recently to go over their game plan ahead of the large UN climate conference, COP27. Kind of like a climate boot camp. This year's conference takes place in Egypt, and the key objective by climate activists this year is climate adaptation funding and getting wealthy countries who have done the most to cause climate change to help poor countries who have seen the worst impacts of climate change. Last year, during COP26, delegates promised just $350 million to go towards helping the worst impacted countries. The climate campaigners are working to figure out the best ways to hold wealthy countries accountable for actually making these payments. Speaking of accountability, the Duncan's First Nation in Northern Alberta is suing the Albertan government for infringing on Treaty 8 rights to freely practice traditional ways of life by approving way too many industrial activities in their territory. By industrial activities, I mainly mean fossil fuel projects. Treaties were signed by many First Nations in Canada in the late 1800s with the promise that Indigenous people's lands would be protected. But these promises were quickly broken to make way for fossil fuels, big agriculture, and other forms of development and land change. This lawsuit is nearly identical to the one the BC Supreme Court ruled on last year. In that one, the Blueberry River First Nations sued the British Columbian government over infringing on their treaty rights through too many industrial activities. So exactly the same. The BC Supreme Court sided with the First Nation, and the BC government didn't appeal the decision. This was the first time the courts ruled on cumulative impact, and it gave the Blueberry River First Nation and all the First Nations in BC the power to block development on their land. The Duncan's First Nation is hoping for the same result in Alberta, even copying the wording Blueberry River used in its suit. But the BC court's decision is not legally binding in Alberta. Alberta's government is even more pro-industry, aka pro-fossil fuels, making this a harder case to win, but also a more profound one against the oil and gas industry if it sides in the favor of the First Nations. As Kate Gunn, a lawyer for the First Peoples Law, states, quote, "It would be hard for an Albertan court to say that only nations who signed in BC are guaranteed their continued way of life." I guess we'll have to wait and see. On Tuesday, we talked about the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA's, alleged poor dispersal of money meant to spur climate-smart agriculture practices. I thought it would be a good follow-up to just talk about what the plans are from the Inflation Reduction Act. First of all, I think I said $12 billion. I meant $22 billion. $22 billion is the correct number allocated from the bill to the USDA for climate-smart agriculture. $2.8 billion of that is going to go to research and implementation of climate smart production on 20 million to 25 million acres of working land. And about $19.5 billion is going to shore up existing agricultural conservation programs like the two that the Environmental Working Group said need to be reformed fast. Not only are those programs not spending money in the right spaces, but they are also letting a very limited of farmers actually join. Two-thirds of farmers are turned away from these programs. The USDA has recently received about 1,000 Climate Smart Agriculture pilot program applications totaling around $20 billion. That definitely shows demand, so it's just a matter of getting the funds to where they're needed most. Sustainable agriculture is still a niche part of the larger sector, but it is growing. There are 900 million acres of farmland in the U.S., and about 100 million of it uses a non-tilling system, which helps keep carbon in the soil. Farmers that plant cover crops and sow to prevent soil erosion and increase soil moisture only control about 15 million acres. Over to the energy sector now. The think tank Third Way determines that the combination of recent laws passed in the U.S. will spur 500,000 new clean energy jobs by 2050. The laws it's referring to are the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the biggest climate bill in U.S. history, the CHIPS Act, which spurred domestic chip manufacturing development, and the Infrastructure Bill. Clean energy jobs are any jobs that deal with clean produced power, carbon dioxide removal and transport, clean fuels, energy efficiency, grid expansion, energy storage, and electric vehicles. Every state and DC will see at least a bit of this job growth by 2030, with greater gains by 2050. The part of the U.S. that will see the most job growth is actually the Midwest, where more than 146,000 new jobs are expected by 2030. Third Way sees a net gain in jobs even in fossil fuel-heavy areas like Texas and Appalachia, though a previous study published in Scientific Reports notes that these places are more vulnerable to the clean energy transition and might require a little extra support in the transition. But overall, that's a lot of new jobs. The U.S.'s first grid-scale hybrid wind-solar battery plant just went online in Oregon. Built by NextEra and Portland General Electric, the Wheat Ridge Renewable Energy Facilities comprises 300 megawatts of wind, 50 megawatts of solar, and 30 megawatts of battery storage with a four-hour duration. Working with both wind and solar allows the plant to generate power during more hours in the day and even at night. It supports PGE's goal of reducing its greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2030 to achieving net zero emissions by 2040. NextEra owns the wind turbines, while PGE owns the solar and battery storage. A new transmission line was constructed to connect this project to a high voltage grid operated by Bonneville Power Association. Now let's get into the climate fails. Remember, don't get despondent, get mad. We've got to start by talking about what Italy's change in leadership means for its energy plans. As many of you probably know, Italy elected a right-wing government led by far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, while the previous liberal administration was starting to head the 19th historically largest emitter towards expanding its clean energy portfolio. Meloni, who has said next to nothing about climate change, seems to be in favor of gas and nuclear, making up most of the power production. For gas, Meloni's government wants to increase domestic gas production to gain energy independence. Italy is a very fossil fuel heavy state, with gas and oil making up about 41 and 34% respectively of the country's energy supply in 2019. Coal made up another 6%, leaving just about 19% for renewables, half of which are biomass, which often means burning wood or using biofuels linked to deforestation. So bottom line, Italy's energy supply is very dirty. But what about nuclear? Italy actually hasn't had any nuclear plants since the Chernobyl scare spurred a nuclear referendum in 1987. Starting the investment of nuclear now as Italy's main form of clean energy won't fit the timeline needed to keep warming well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels because nuclear takes a while to build. Italy's also part of the EU, which has a target of reducing emissions by 55% by 2030. In order for Italy to receive the 300 billion euros EU allotted for post-COVID recovery, the country must use 37% of it on climate action. Meloni has not been the biggest fan of the EU for most of her career, and if she joins the Eastern European countries like Poland in blocking climate efforts, this could actually substantially hinder the EU's effort to effectively decarbonize. Let's check out the world of finance now, in the form of the World Bank. The World Bank has been under fire ever since its president wouldn't initially say he agrees that humans are causing climate change. President Malpass has since clarified that he does understand that fact. But that hasn't stopped over 50 climate groups like the League of Conservative Voters, the Center of American Progress, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Climate Reality Project, Greenpeace, and Friends of the Earth from issuing a letter to the U.S. President Biden to replace Malpass. The U.S. is the largest contributor of the World Bank, so it can appoint the president of the World Bank. Malpass was Trump's pick. The World Bank has defended Malpass by citing its climate financing efforts, but this has just put the climate financing under closer scrutiny. Now the bank's climate finance record is in question because it's failing to show receipts for up to 40% of its climate funding history. The World Bank reported it spent $17.2 billion on climate finance in 2020, but according to Oxfam, $7 billion cannot be independently verified. Climate finance can be in the form of proactively adapting to climate change or decarbonizing different sectors. More specifically, Oxfam looked at the $21.3 billion that the bank reportedly spent on climate finance that year, $17.3 billion of which was spent through the bank's two main lending arms, the International Development Association and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. The Oxfam researchers used the bank's own methodology to see if they could reproduce the $17.2 billion, and they couldn't. The researchers think that this is due to many projects having a climate action element, but not fully being just for that purpose, making it hard to determine how much of the funding for the project should be considered climate funding. The World Bank refuted Oxfam's claims and said that it allocated $31.7 billion for climate financing this year. Sounds like just another number for Oxfam to check up on at the end of the year. We need to talk about corporate debt. Yes, very fun topic, I know. It turns out that debt finance, largely through bank loans and bond assurances, is responsible for about 90% of new capital for fossil fuel companies. Yet pressuring bond investors has so far not been the focus of climate campaigners. The debt industry is worth $22 trillion. Now, there's such a thing as green bonds, where the money raised through these bonds is meant to go towards cutting emissions. Since the first sustainability-linked bond, or SLB, was issued back in 2008, $1 trillion worth has been issued. SLBs are cheaper than regular bonds because they're meant to help companies reach their green goals. If a company doesn't meet its goal, though, it'll receive a higher penalty. But some companies have been using SLBs as a way to get cheaper loans, which has seemingly not been properly counteracted by investors dishing out harsher penalties like they're supposed to. According to the analysis, investors seem to have either a lack of understanding or an indifference towards fulfilling sustainability goals. The head of the Climate Bonds Initiative said the SLB market is, quote unquote, broken. This is unfortunate because the idea of SLBs could actually lead to great decarbonization efforts. The Bloomberg Green Team wonders if these bonds could be used more efficiently if countries rather than corporations wield them. The country Chile has invested in SLBs to cut absolute emissions by 15% by 2030 and increase renewables to reach half of its energy supply by 2028. If Chile fails, it will have to pay the bond investors higher interest rates. This is an example of SLBs actually making a climate difference. The reporters at Bloomberg say that developing countries with low historical emissions should get cheaper loans to even out the playing field. If you want to learn more about these concepts, which are very interesting but very complex, check out the source list linked below. Should federal courts weigh in on state and local climate lawsuits against giant oil companies? That's what the Supreme Court just asked the Justice Department after Exxon and Suncor asked SCOTUS to weigh in on the case that they're facing in Colorado right now. Local Colorado officials are seeking damages against these two companies over climate change. This is one of many climate lawsuits against fossil fuel companies in local and state courts right now. Frankly, local and state courts are more likely to side with plaintiffs over the fossil fuel companies compared to the conservative supermajority Supreme Court, so that's why fossil fuel companies are asking. The fossil fuel companies say climate law is a matter for Congress and the executive branch, not states' issues. The Biden administration hasn't released a statement on this matter yet, so this is something to look forward to. This decision could have large ramifications in the world of climate law. Lastly, I would like to promote myself. If you are on Twitch, this Friday, we will look at some of the top House of Representative midterm races to see what each candidate's climate positions are. And that was your climate recap for Thursday, October 6th. If you like the work I do, please follow this podcast, give it a 5-star rating, leave a review, and consider checking out the Becosphere Climate Corner YouTube channel. Remember to talk about the climate crisis every single day and to support your local news organizations. Bye for now.